Well, I know there's a few teachers and teaching assistants in the room with us, and I'm about to say a word that's going to send a shock down your spines. Ofsted. Maybe you have a little bit of post-traumatic stress disorder from having gone through an Ofsted inspection, and maybe you're anticipating an upcoming Ofsted inspection. All of us have been to schools, and so all of us no doubt have sat in whilst our teachers have been inspected. And so we know that Ofsted is the bane of most teachers' life, isn't it? When are Ofsted going to come? What are Ofsted going to want? What happened at other schools in the area? There's all these charts and comparisons to try and find out when the day will come. But the hour of the day is unknown when it comes to Ofsted. It comes like a thief in the night. And when they finally come, Ofsted give a judgment that will pass over the school and be there for years to come. Maybe outstanding. If it's outstanding, they usually have a banner outside the front, don't they? Maybe good. Maybe requires improvement. Maybe inadequate. Maybe they've changed the label since I was teaching, but it's something along those lines. Years of teaching evaluated by one simple label. And because it's such a big deal, shapes all of the teachers. Stress and concerns for many weeks, months, and even years. And perhaps you will have something similar in your life. Maybe if you're a young person, you'll think that way about exams coming up. 2 years of work, and it's all going to be evaluated in a short period of time. Or for those in work, you might have those annual reviews where you've got to justify what you've been doing year after year, or perhaps a big presentation. Everyone hates those moments of judgment. We build up to them, we worry about them, we're concerned about them for months and years. But there is a greater judgment we forget, isn't there? An Ofsted inspection for the whole world, for each individual soul. Nations will gather around Jesus' throne to be judged. The day is unknown, and there are only two labels on this occasion. Justified and not justified. Heaven and how? Sheep and the goats. But the strange thing about this, despite it being the greatest judgment we will ever sit through, very few of us are concerned about it. Unlike the teachers or the people preparing for exams, concerns, trying to work towards that judgment day that is coming, many of us give barely any thought to what will happen on that day, when all of our deeds will be judged before the throne of God. And that's why sometimes it can be helpful for us to go away from that final judgment, to look at passages in the Old Testament, to historical events that teach us about individual judgment days, and they make it feel a little bit more real. And what we see in today's passage is Absalom's judgment day. And most of you will have been here for the past few weeks. You'll know that Absalom lived a life like judgment was never going to come. He murdered. He set farms on fire. He stole the throne from his father. He committed gross acts of indecency on the roof of Jerusalem in front of everyone. He thought he could do whatever he wanted and no judgment was coming. But in this passage, that judgment finally comes. Perhaps you and I sometimes live like Absalom. We live our lives as if God is never going to bring us to his judgment throne. Perhaps we aren't quite as dramatic as Absalom. Maybe on a Sunday we put on a brave face, but that future judgment isn't shaping our life in the way that it should. Well, as we look at this brutal story of what happened to Absalom, I hope we're going to see three things that will shape the way we view our judgment, which is to come. We're going to see the certainty of judgment, we're going to see the necessity of judgment, and we're going to see the tears of judgment as well. Well, let's look through this passage and see what it has to say. And each of those labels, I think they're going to be attached to a particular person in this story. And firstly, we're going to look at Absalom himself. And in that, we see the certainty of judgment. As we said before, Absalom lived like judgment wasn't coming, but judgment arrived in this passage, and it's very clear. But it's not just a freak accident. This is the judgment of God on Absalom through his rebellion against God and his king. You remember 2 weeks ago, Absalom had ignored the advice to strike David quickly. So we're going forward a bit in time, and he decides to march against David himself. This is the place of his downfall. And the battle takes place in a forest. Now, a forest is a great place to be fighting a battle if you're the smaller force, because the army can't see where you're hidden. So you can do the whole Robin Hood thing and hide in the trees and attack and jump out and surprise people, pick people off one by one. So it is brilliant for David's forces. And Absalom is one of those who is siphoned off one by one. We read in verse 9 of chapter 18. Now Absalom happened to meet David's men. He was riding his mule, and as the mule went under the thick branches of a large oak, Absalom's hair got caught in the tree. He was left hanging in midair, while the mule he was riding kept on going. You remember Absalom's hair was his pride and joy. He was a bit of a David Junalar for the ancient people of Israel. But that same hair that he took pride in became his noose. Tangled in a tree, he was hanging, helpless. Now there's more to it than just a bit of irony with his hair. Many of you will know that in Deuteronomy, God said, cursed is everyone who hangs from a tree. It's not just an unfortunate accident. God is demonstrating his curse upon Absalom. And we also see God's role of cursing in Absalom's burial. If we skip forward a little bit to verse 17, it says, they took Absalom, threw him into a big pit in the forest, and piled a large heap of rocks over him. Meanwhile, all the Israelites fled to their homes. Now, that means nothing to you and me. Why are they telling us where he was buried and what they did? But actually, this is a burial that is a cursed burial. Way back when, people like us who weren't part of the Anglican establishment, we couldn't be buried in churchyards. We had to be buried wherever, which is probably why we've got a burial ground around the back of ours. You weren't allowed to be buried on sanctified ground because you'd rejected the Church of England. It was a symbol of curse from the establishment to the people of who had rejected the established church. The burial was very political in that sense, not the case now, and I'm sure there were many people at the time who thought it was wrong. But that's what's going on here as well. This is a cursed burial. This isn't the kind of burial that you want to happen. In the book of Joshua, a man named Achan came under God's curse for stealing some of the things God had devoted to himself. And when he was put to death, he too is described as being buried in a pit, covered over with stones. This is a great dishonor. It shows that God has caught up with him. He is not getting the burial that he would want, a burial of respect and honor. God is cursing him. And there's a bitter irony between that burial and another monument Absalom has for himself in verse 18. During his lifetime, Absalom had taken a pillar and erected it in the king's valley as a monument to himself. For he thought, I have no son to carry on the memory of my name. He named the pillar after himself. It is called Absalom's Monument to this day. Absalom had made a monument to himself. Think of how that compares with David. David had wanted to build a temple for God's name to bring glory to him. And then David's son was meant to be the one to complete that task, and Solomon would go on to do that. But Absalom, he'd wanted to make a monument to himself and his own glory. And now many people would pass that monument and say, who's Absalom? Why did he make a monument? The irony was that this great monument Absalom had made to his own glory was just another picture of the fact that he was cursed by God. Without judgment from God, men like Absalom will always win. They'll grasp for power, they'll work through politics, they'll take advantage of the weak, they'll build great monuments to themselves and how amazing they are. There's no one to stop powerful men like that, except an infinitely more powerful God. Justice will surely come, not because the world's always fair, but because God is always fair. Now, judgment isn't always immediate, but it is certain. We should see God's hand working through our justice system. We should praise God when murderers are caught, when rapists are brought to justice, when corrupt politicians are knocked out of government. God is working through this. But even more than that, on the last day, God will bring all works into the open, and every sin will be judged. And so we should praise God for the certainty of judgment. But at the same time, we should be struck by it and what it means for us. In the world we live, it's easy for us to live like atheists, to think that there's no one watching when the eye of other people isn't on us. It starts with the children stealing the cookies from the cookie jar, knowing that they're not going to get told off. It ends with grown men cheating on their expenses claims or 1,000 other things. We act as if there's no final reckoning, as if other people don't see it, and if we're not going to go to prison, well, it doesn't matter. But God does see, and God does judge. He judges not just our actions, but our words and even the thoughts of our hearts. And we can't run away from him. We may look successful, the world may not care that we've done something wrong, but judgment inevitably comes. There is going to be a judgment day to come. There is going to be an accounting of all of your sin. Don't bend the rules to get things on earth. It is not a good trait. The example of Absalom should remind us that the end of rebellion is always judgment. So confess your secret sin to God. Trust in his Son for forgiveness. The sword of judgment is going to come, and you need to do something about it. So that's a certainty of judgment. But you might be thinking, well, why does God need to judge your sin? And that brings us to the necessity of judgment. For this, we're going to look at the person of Joab. Now, Joab's not a particularly famous person in the Bible, but if you can remember all the things Joab's done throughout this book, you'll remember he's a bit of a mixed bag. He was involved in bringing Absalom back in the first place. He's constantly going against David's commands. He does love David. It's clear that that's the case, but he is willing to do some pretty dark stuff to get David's will to happen, and he's willing to ignore David whenever it suits him. So when Joab finds Absalom, he commands one of his men to strike Absalom down, or in fact it's one of Joab's men who tells Joab. Now the soldier refuses, doesn't he? Joab tells him he would have given him 10 shekels of silver. The man replies, "Even if 1,000 shekels were weighed out in my hands, I would not lay a hand on the king's son. In our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai, protect the young Absalom for my sake. And if I had put my life in jeopardy, and nothing is hidden from the king, you would have kept your distance from me." Joab basically can have none of this. Even though he knows what the king has commanded, even though all of his men know what the king has commanded, Joab just says, "I'm not going to wait like this for you." So he took 3 javelins in his hands and plunged them into Absalom's heart while Absalom was still alive in the oak tree. Now, if it isn't obvious, that is not a good thing. He's taking justice into his own hands. He's refusing to obey God's king. This was a sinful action. You've got to remember, the book of 2 Samuel is a book of history. It's not a book of myths. And that means that when we look at people, they don't quite break down into black and white. The only hero in the book of 2 Samuel is God. And everyone else has their flaws. Yeah, there is something interesting that Joab points out later in this passage. When we turn over the page to chapter 19, David is weeping over Absalom's death. And Joab rebukes him. Verses 5 to 7, he says this: "Joab went into the house to the king and said, 'Today you have humiliated all your men who just saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters and the lives of your wives and concubine. You love those who hate you and hate those who love you. You've made it clear today that the commanders and their men mean nothing to you. I see that you would be pleased if Absalom were alive today and all of us were dead. Now go out and encourage your men. I swear by the Lord that if you don't go out, not a man will be left with you by nightfall. This will be worse for you than all the calamities that have come on you from your youth till now. Now, Joab's clearly lost his temper somewhat. Not the way that we should be speaking to a king. But yet, Joab does strike on something that's very true. Joab isn't confronting David as a friend. Surely any friend would acknowledge that, of course, you're going to feel sad if your son has died. But Joab is confronting David as a king, and that is a very different set of circumstances. As a king, David can't behave like any other parent would. He's humiliating the men who have just saved his lives, who've just offered their lives for him. Imagine on the day Winston Churchill got up to the microphone, tears streaming down his face, and saying, "We cannot celebrate today. My dear friend Adolf Hitler has died." Terrible Winston Churchill accent, I apologise. But imagine if he said that, he'd get lynched. That men have just given their lives to get Adolf Hitler off the throne, or the equivalent, in Germany. He couldn't have done that, even if Adolf Hitler was his best friend. Well, it's like that here. It's right for David to love his boy, and we'll think about that in a few moments. But Absalom rebelled against God. He rebelled against God's king. He put the lives of God's people in danger. He had to be judged. Whatever David felt about it, he had to bring the sword of judgment upon him. Joab shouldn't have taken these matters into his own hands. But God was sovereign over that because Absalom needed to be judged. As Joab tells him, you can't love those who hate you and hate those who love you. You can't love Absalom more than us. Now, of course, on some level, of course, he loves Absalom more than his people. But as a king, he's got to put his feelings to one side. If Prince William committed murder, it would be wrong for Charles III to use his influence to get William off. We would all be scandalized by that. We recognize that there is a justice that's got to stand whatever you feel like for family reasons. David should have judged Absalom. He should have put Absalom to death for his crimes. Joab is right to remind him of that, even though all the other actions he does are wrong. Well, what does that teach you and me? Many of us think Judgment Day is some weird quirk of God, like a bit of a flaw in his personality. Now, why can't God just say, let's just wipe away everything, everyone's forgiven, it doesn't matter what you've done. Well, for the same reason, David couldn't forgive Absalom like that. Judgment is necessary. No matter how much you love someone, there is a standard of justice that must be upheld. If it was necessary for David, how much more necessary for God? He judges the whole universe. Where else would we turn if he was not going to give us true justice? It is necessary for God to punish sin. The world has been filled with all kinds of evil because of the sin you and I have committed. There's war, there's murder, there's natural disaster, there's family breakdown. Every tear in this world has its origin in the acts you and I have done against God's. There is a judgment, and there must be a judgment because of the effect of sin. Some people, like Absalom, assume judgment will never come. Some people think if there is a judgment, God will bend the rules, or he should do if he was a loving God. But no, judgment is necessary. Just as King David had to judge his son no matter how much he loved him, so God must judge as well. Well, what hope is there for us in them? Well, finally, we're going to look at David and we're going to see the tears of judgment. And initially it's not going to look like good news, but hang on with me in there. David and the tears of judgment. Now, there's two words you could use to describe David in this passage, and I think you'd sum him up pretty well. The first is merciful. He wants to forgive his son. But the second is helpless. As much as he wants his son to be forgiven, he can't. He can't take away the judgment. You see that helplessness right at the start. He's there saying he wants to march out with the troops, and his men talk him down. They say, you must not go. If we're forced to flee, they won't care about us. Even if half of us die, they won't care. But you are worth 10,000 of us. The sense in this, that if David dies, it's game over. And David at this point is probably not the young man who was going off and fighting wars for Saul. If he's got an adult son, like Absalom, who could have been up to the age of about 30, then David is probably past his prime for fighting battles. I guess most of you with adult children probably would feel that you wouldn't be quite as good in a battle as you were when you were a bit younger. And that was the case with David. David can't go out. He can't fight this battle. So he relents, but he gives one condition. He says, chapter 18, verse 5, be gentle with the young man Absalom for my sake. He commands that to Joab, Abishai, and Ittai, the commanders of each of the thirds of his army. All of the troops hear it as well. And yet, as we know, although David desired this merciful action, he lacked the power to bring it about. He was helpless to stop Joab taking matters into his own hands. What does he do when he finds out about Absalom? Well, verse 33, the king was shaken. He went up to the room over the gateway and wept. As he went, he said, oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son. David is utterly distraught, as any parent would be. No matter how terrible your child is, you love them even more than yourself. He wishes he could have died in Absalom's place. And the whole army, as a result, is overcome with sorrow. Now, this isn't just politically helpful. You know, sometimes people say, oh, well, you know, it's very sad that this has happened, and they don't mean it at all. That's clearly not the case with David. There's actually no political advantage in him weeping over Absalom. As Joab said, your men are going to go away from you. You carry on like this. David is overcome with a genuine mercy towards this hostile son, this rebellious son, wishing he could die in his son's place. What does that show us? Well, firstly, let me talk about what it might say to some of us in the room before we think of the bigger picture. Many of you in the room today are parents. And for many of you parents, the deepest pain that you suffer is the pain of a son or daughter that has rejected you. Maybe they've sinned against you in horrific ways, but you would forgive them in a heartbeat if they were willing. Maybe it's not so much that they've been cruel to you, but they've walked away from God and you can't see them coming back. One of the things that you notice as you go through 1 and 2 Samuel is that this pain comes up again and again and again. Eli's sons, Eli the high priest, his sons disgrace him and are judged. Samuel's sons are rejected as his heirs because they don't live up to the standard of their father. David has Amnon and Absalom, both horrendous young men. Ironically, the only man who had a good and godly son was Saul, and he was an ungodly man. It's very clear here that there's no direct line from godly parents to godly children. It'd be great if there was, wasn't it? Or maybe it wouldn't, because there's few of us who could live up to that standard. Many godly parents have to face the struggle of children that reject them, that hurt them, reject the gods that they love. On one hand, that should stop any of us from having pride if we have Christian children. It's not because we were A-grade parents that happened. And it should stop any guilt from Christians with children who go away from God. There are things that we can do which stop our children following the way of the Lord. We should be trying to raise them in the knowledge of the truth. But there are times when parents do everything right and it just doesn't have the effect that it should. Now, these things cause so much pain. They cause so much weeping as David wept. And there is, in a sense, no easy answer to that pain. But at the very least, we can acknowledge that the Bible acknowledges it's there and we can bring it to God as a result. But there is more going on than just how we feel when we have prodigal sons and daughters ourselves. David is a representative of God's king. He represents God's attitude to his people. And in David's tears, we see the kind of tears, metaphorically, that God weeps over judgment. Later in Israel's history, he says through Ezekiel, "Do I take any pleasure in the death of the wicked, declares the sovereign Lord? Rather, am I not pleased when they turn from their ways and live?" God, like David, takes no delight in judgment. Does that mean that God's like David then? Merciful, but helpless. Well, no. Because there's one thing David couldn't do that God could and did. And what David said, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son, if only I had died instead of you." David would have loved to have offered himself in Absalom's place to die for his sin, but he didn't have that right. He wasn't a perfect substitute. He couldn't tell God who to judge. But God could do that. David's greater descendant said the same thing about every Christian in this room. "Oh, my son, oh, my daughter, if only I could die instead of you. In fact, no, I will die instead of you." He took on human flesh. He suffered the pains of life, but lived an absolutely perfect life without fault, something David could never claim. And he was hung on a tree, not by his hair, but by nails in his hands, cursed by God. He was given a place with the wicked in his death. He suffered for the sin of his people. He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him. He died instead of us. And that is tremendous news for you and I. Because although we're no better than Absalom, we don't need to have his fate. Judgment Day can be a day of joy rather than sorrow. Jesus, through this passage, is speaking to you this morning. He's saying to you, judgment is certain. It is as certain as it was for Absalom. If you think you can escape it and live your life the way you want to, look what that led to for Absalom. It's a dangerous thing to ignore the judgment day to come. But he also shows you himself. He shows you himself weeping tears over Jerusalem and tears over you, longing that you would be saved. He shows you his willingness to be cursed in your place so that you can be blessed for all eternity. Some of you here this morning, you're going headfirst to judgment because you're pretending like that day isn't going to come. Listen to that warning through this passage. You can't outrun God's judgment forever. It may come in a week, it may come in a year, it may come decades from now, but it will surely come. And if you ignore God, then that day will be the worst imaginable, the beginning of many worse days to come. You needn't go there, because our King, our God, is willing to take that punishment on himself. And so if you haven't yet turned to him, can I encourage you today to hear his cry, "Oh, my son, oh, my daughter, if only I died instead of you." Say, "Father, I know that I am like Absalom. I know I deserve judgment. But forgive me, because Jesus died in my place." And as for those of us who are Christians, we can look to the day of judgment without fear. Yes, we want to live in such a way that we glorify our God, but we can look to it without fear because we know that the curse hasn't fallen on us, but has fallen on Jesus instead. And that gives us reason to sing his praise both now and for all eternity.